Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Wuerl, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity entitled The Lifelong Care of Individuals with Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome, Strategies for Outcomes Optimization from Childhood through Adulthood. This program is supported by an independent medical education grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. This activity may include discussions on products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the FDA, and our speakers will disclose that. So as I mentioned, I am Dr. Elaine Wuerl. I'm professor and chair of child neurology at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm delighted to be joined today by two very distinguished colleagues who I'm going to ask to introduce themselves, starting with Tracy Dixon-Salazar.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tracy Dixon-Salazar, Executive Director of the Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome Foundation. I have a 31-year-old daughter who has Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome, and it's an honor to be here to share her story with you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Bethany Thomas. I've actually worked as a nurse in the epilepsy space for 15 years, starting as an inpatient nurse in the epilepsy monitoring unit, and now working as an outpatient epilepsy nurse practitioner at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, where I treat adult epilepsy patients. So very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So let's start by going over our learning objectives for today. The first learning objective is to evaluate disease burden and impact of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome on quality of life for both patients and caregivers. The second objective is to utilize diagnostic criteria and distinguishing features of Lennox-Gastaut to achieve an early and accurate diagnosis in all patients. And our third objective is to develop strategies to optimize management of Lennox-Gastaut across patients' lifespans. So I'm going to now turn things over to Tracy, who's going to talk about the burden of Lennox-Gastaut on patients and caregivers.
Thank you, Elaine. Before we get started, I want to get the audience involved and ask you what you know about Lennox-Gastaut syndrome with this quiz. So here's your quiz you can answer on your iPad. Which of the following is a common non-seizure symptom seen in Lennox-Gastaut syndrome? All right, here we go, sleep disorders, and that is the correct answer, 43% was sleep disorders. So I'm going to share a little bit about my daughter's journey and what Lennox-Gastaut syndrome is, and I'll start with this slide. Let's try to encapsulate in a short amount of time what it was like in the first 5 years living with this disease, and it's auto-advancing, I don't know why, but we'll just keep going back. Savannah was actually born healthy, which is true for 1 in 3 with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. She didn't have her first seizure or any sign that anything was wrong with her until she was 2 and a half. She had a seizure out of the blue. We didn't even know what it was. We thought she was choking. Called the paramedics, and they go, her airway's clear, and what you described is over, but it sounds just like a seizure. My husband and I both asked, what's a seizure? And over the next couple of months, she would have 4 seizures, and then she went 6 months without having any seizures at all. And I point this out because we often talk about Lennox-Gastaut as being this static thing, but it's not. It evolves over time. And during that time, when the seizures emerged when she was 3, she started having hundreds of seizures a day, too many to count on some days. And at that point, we started to see frequent epileptiform activity between seizures. And there was this interplay with this that started to cause developmental delay. We started to treat with different medications. And then this ultimately led to her developing the characteristic EEG features of LGS, which are slow spike and wave and generalized paroxysmal fast activity. But nobody is born with those. They evolve over time in LGS. And she wasn't diagnosed with LGS till the age of 5, but who knows when it really emerged. Those times for us were absolute hell. And, we didn't know what we were doing, and we were very much in the mindset of, what is it? How do we stop it? What do we do? And I would say from the age of until about 5 to about 10, we were like, how do we stop it? How do we stop it? And then by 10, we were like, how do we live with it? From the time Savannah was had her first seizure till the time she was 18, she had more than 40,000 seizures as her mother. All I could do was really count them. So I did, and like I said, some days I just said too many to count. It took her 3 years to get the diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Before that, she had intractable epilepsy, and she has both. She also has developmental delay. I think a lot of our families think that you can only have one diagnosis, but our kids have so many. It took us 15 years to find the etiology of her seizures in her. She has calcium channel mutations, which started the seizures. So many neurologists, very, very expensive. And LGS is, you know, is like I said, it's something that evolves over time. And these patients, they start to have seizures beyond just what you would expect from regular seizures. They start to have delays in their development over time. And pretty much by the time the seizures came back at the age of three, Savannah stopped developing. When we think about the seizures, we think about a lot of the different impacts, weekly status epilepticus, clusters, potential SUDEP. She would get aspiration pneumonia all the time. We were regulars in the ER on a first-name basis. And she, by the time she was seven, was being diagnosed with brain matter atrophy, which nobody really told us what that mean. But there's so many other issues. There's behaviors. There's communication issues, mostly expressive. There's issues with in academics. She doesn't read or write, even though she's 31 years old now, she doesn't. There's the mobility and physical care issues. There's sleep. You know, there's constipation, bone density, social isolation, you know, issues with access. And so it's hard to know where to start. So we actually asked our families what was the number one thing they were dealing with. And honestly, it was the seizures and the seizure safety. And number two was expressive communication. Can my kid just tell me they're hungry, they're in pain, they're thirsty? It affects the whole family. And I like this graphic here on your right because it talks about really what our lives were like for the first 18 years. If we weren't in crisis mode, which was seizures or status or injury or infection, you know, we were in avoid crisis mode. Is she just eating, sleeping, pooping, peeing, taking her meds, drinking, breathing? That's it. Don't talk to me about school. I'm just trying to keep this kid alive. And when Savannah was 18 years old, we actually found her cause, and we found a medicine that dropped her seizures by 95%. And this went on for 12 years, and she started to learn again. She stopped going into status all the time. And so we graduated to the yellow level there, which is coping mode. Is she avoiding crisis unassisted by caregivers? And still at 31, even though she would be considered an LGS success story with such an incredible medication that helped her, it's an off-label med used for calcium channels to block them, she still doesn't do anything independently because of the years of seizures. She is 31 now, though, and she is a success story that these kids are not hopeless. We get told a lot by physicians, go home, love your child, they're going to die. And I don't think that's really the message that we want to be sending. The message is these are beloved children. We love them. They deserve a chance at life as everybody, and they need the supports to make it through. So what is LGS? It really is a collection of these features. It's a developmental and epileptic encephalopathy. There's multiple seizure types, most of the time, almost always drug-resistant, and they have cognitive and behavioral abnormalities. They affect about 1% to 2% of all kids with epilepsy, so they are not uncommon. They will often evolve from early-life epilepsy syndromes like IESS or West syndrome. Usually the seizures begin in the first year of life based on research, but they can present between 18 months and 8 years. The most common onset for the LGS itself is 3 to 5 years, but the seizures are often occurring much earlier. And it persists into adulthood. I've had many physicians, adult doctors say, oh, well, it's a pediatric disease. No, they grow up and they live. And mentally, they're often still infants and toddlers, but they do go into adult care and require specialized care. There's a broad range of causes for the seizures that cause LGS, it really depends on how good of a doctor you had and how deeply they investigate to find the cause. And we say now that it's so important to find the etiology of the seizures because there are so many new treatments that are coming out that are targeted towards the etiologies, especially genetic etiologies. So the acquired represent about 28%, metabolic is about 2%. Developmental to genetic is about 37%. And you can also be genetic and have an acquired insult. You can have genetic and a metabolic insult. So it's really important to look. We still don't know the cause, though, in about 25 to 35% of cases. And so the way we talk about LGS, we often like to say that somebody like my daughter has LGS secondary to calcium channel mutations. Both the syndrome and the etiology are critically important to get your patients access to the best treatments that are out there. The seizures in LGS are very specific. You need to have tonic seizures predominantly at night. Atonic seizures and atypical absence are also really common. Most of the kids in our 8,000-member community are seizing every day or every week. There's other associated seizure types that are listed here, which are it really sort of anything goes. You know, you can have focal motor, you can have focal impaired, and there's a mix. And most of our families in a survey that we've done with them are having between 4 to 10 different seizure types in their loved ones. Non-seizure symptoms are really, really common, and I've listed them here, and it runs the gamut. Anything that the brain can control that can be impacted by a seizure can be impacted by, can have an adverse effect in LGS. And then you start giving them all these medications, and they start to have all of these additional issues. And I think that what really drives me in my work with the LGS Foundation is thinking about the fact that seizures and safety are rated number one for families when you survey about 467 of them. And so the question really is what does your patient want? Who are you working with? What do they prioritize? And then expressive communication. Oftentimes we can't get seizure control, but we can work with them on the quality of life. Often the way these are treated, though, are by going to seeing specialists and adding additional treatments. But in the recent years, we've actually been starting to talk about which treatments actually don't have a negative effect or might even have a positive effect. So if you know that you're treating seizures, you don't want, and you know that they're sleeping all the time, you don't want to put them on something sedating. And that type of thinking is starting to filter into GI issues, into motor issues, into sleep issues as well, which we like. More meds, meh, but thinking about how one med might have like a 2-for-1 is better. The comorbidities evolve with age. Unfortunately, 95% will go on to have intellectual disability. 80% have a decline in their IQ by about 15 points or more over. By adulthood, most have moderate to severe cognitive impairment. Behavior and sleep issues are a major problem. Nobody is sleeping in the house. The caregivers are not sleeping. Patients are not sleeping. The siblings are not sleeping. And then you have all of the behaviors that come. And sometimes the behaviors are seizures. Sometimes the behaviors are, you know, they never got to go through their normal childhood and they didn't learn that you can't, you know, lick people. And sometimes the behaviors are that they do know and they're just being obstinate and trying to figure out which one of them that is really difficult. 15 to 20% will deteriorate in the gait. Most of them need a wheelchair when they get older. And then there's lots of swallowing issues and GI issues. I'm just going to touch in these last few slides on the impact for the patient quality of life. You know, they have all of these seizures, and so it's so hard for them to learn when you're seizing all the time, and it leads to limited ability to communicate and frustration and aggression. There's a lot of risks of falls and injuries, and you turn your back for 1 second, and they have yet another skull fracture, you know, and you know you can't watch them perfectly always. We self-imprison in our own homes, and we limit our social interactions because there's a lot of concrete in the world, and we feel very isolated, and there's a really high increase of death in our community, and as you as neuroscience nurses are seeing that. And so what this adds up to is the unpredictability, the frequency, and the severity of seizures are just the beginning of it, but that leads to an inability to make plans on the family, right? You're now managing all of the appointments in the specialist. You're battling the system-level barriers. You're trying to become educated. I actually ended up getting my PhD just to try to understand what physicians were thinking when they were treating my kid. You know, trying to balance the impacts of your multiple siblings, and it's just really, really challenging. And mostly you're just trying to keep them alive. And this leads to a chronic traumatic stress disorder, I think that all of us are suffering from as caregivers of LGS, where we're just on constant stress overload. So when you're working with these families, just know that they're in this constant state of fear, anxiety, worry, exhaustion, and we're doing the best that we can. I think one of the best things that we can do is to help them not lose hope, to find a doctor that just hasn't given up and really wants to work with our loved one across the lifespan, because they are very precious to us. And even though we're afraid of the future and they're seizing a lot, they love life. They just want to live, and they have the right to. And so I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk, and I'll turn it back over to Elaine.
Tracy, that was a wonderful presentation, and thank you so much for sharing your lived experience. I was wondering if you or Bethany can just comment on what role do you think nurses can play in helping caregivers and families negotiate this very, very challenging diagnosis?
I can speak a little bit to the nursing role. I think that Tracy did such an excellent job in highlighting all of the different specialties that they need to take care of a patient who has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And one of the things that really sticks out for me is nursing is such a unique role that they may play a part in any of those parts. Even here at this conference, neuroscience nursing encompasses nurses who are working in the hospital, outside of the hospital, in the home, as caregivers, sometimes as caseworkers.
caregivers, and all of those different areas in which you touch both the patient and the family, you really are in a prime position to advocate for them, to support them in accessing all of the care that they need for all of those different challenges that they're facing.
I would agree. I think nurses are the lifeblood of so much of what we do, and you know, they're the ones that we interact with the most, and just helping us, you know, with our child in whatever setting that they're in. But also realizing that when you guys are not there, we are doing it, and caregivers often know so much. So allowing them to bring that knowledge, it makes us feel like we're not being beaten down by this disease, but we actually have something to do and something to say.
Well, thank you very much for that great discussion, and there'll be more at the end of the session. So I'm going to take over now and talk about catching it early, how we can recognize and diagnose Lennox-Gastaut accurately and early. And we're going to start with the case, and this is Connor, who is a 4-year-old boy who presents with drug-resistant tonic seizures, focal seizures, as well as atypical absences. His first seizures occurred at 10 months of age, and he was initially diagnosed with non-syndromic focal epilepsy. Before his seizures, his development was normal. Unfortunately, he has developed behavioral issues, including hyperactivity and self-injurious behavior. He's had increasing cognitive impairment, limited ability to speak, and he undergoes a video EEG, which confirms frequent tonic seizures with paroxysmal fast activity and interictal generalized slow spike wave complex. So the question is, which result of Connor's examination would be most likely to indicate Lennox-Gastaut? So 56% of you said paroxysmal fast activity during sleep, and that is indeed the correct answer. So I'm going to talk a little bit about evolution of Lennox-Gastaut. We've already heard from Tracy, this is not a static disorder, this evolves. And I think what's really important is that at its initial presentation with seizures, there also is evolution. And this was a nice study that was done looking at infants with developmental and epileptic encephalopathies. And at the end point, 22 of those 58 infants actually had a diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut. But if you actually looked at what they were initially diagnosed with, it was other types of epilepsy. In fact, only 4 of these infants were diagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut from the get-go. And we see a lot of infants that evolve from West syndrome or infantile epileptic spasms, from focal epilepsy, from other types of epilepsy, into Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And ultimately, Lennox-Gastaut encompass about 20% of epilepsies beginning in infancy. So it's important that particularly for very, very young infants who develop epilepsy, we need to be following those infants quite carefully. And we heard from Tracy that it took several years for Savannah to get a diagnosis, and that's not uncommon. It takes about 1.9 years on average for all of those features of Lennox-Gastaut to be present in a patient. And we often hear of the diagnostic triad for Lennox-Gastaut, so that's sort of a combination of multiple seizure types. We've already heard that tonic seizures are mandatory for diagnosis, but these patients typically give many other types of seizures, generalized and focal seizures. Non-convulsive status epilepticus is also common. In addition, this pairs with an abnormal EEG with 2 very important findings: interictal slow spike wave, so this is different than what you would see, for example, with childhood absence epilepsy. This is much slower, less than 2.5 hertz. And then we see this very characteristic paroxysmal fast rhythm that come on in sleep on the EEG. And then the third part of that triad is cognitive impairment. So all children with or all persons with Lennox-Gastaut will have developmental delay of variable degrees of severity with sometimes regression over time. And it's important to think about the differential diagnosis of difficult seizures that can occur in children. And so just to summarize here, we've talked about Lennox-Gastaut. One of the most common things that is misdiagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut is epilepsy with myoclonic atonic seizures. We call that EMATS, or Duse syndrome. And this affects otherwise developmentally normal children, typically at a similar age to Lennox-Gastaut. But the seizures are a little bit different, and the mandatory seizure type here are drop seizures, but preceded by a myoclonic jerk. So they'll often jerk, or when they jerk, they might actually vocalize, and then they fall. There's also a bit of a difference on their EEG in that most of those patients do not have the generalized paroxysmal fast activity. Dravet syndrome is also a very severe early life epilepsy, and the presentation is different here, so it usually comes on in the first year of life with prolonged convulsive seizures, often hemiconvulsive seizures, that are characteristically triggered by fever, and they do not have that slow spike wave on their EEG. These kids are developmentally normal at onset, but do develop variable degrees of delay with time. Infantile epileptic spasm syndrome is the new name for West syndrome, and so the characteristic seizure type there is the epileptic spasm, which often occurs in clusters. This typically comes on before a year of age, sometimes as late as two, and the EEG pattern here most commonly shows a hypsarrhythmia. But remember that many children with infantile epileptic spasm syndrome, particularly those who don't respond very well to the spasms therapy, will ultimately evolve to Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And then the last one that I wanted to highlight is developmental and epileptic encephalopathy with spike wave activation in sleep. It's got that lovely acronym. Sometimes this has been called pseudo-Lennox syndrome because they can really have a lot of different types of seizures, some of which can look like Lennox-Gastaut. But the characteristic here is that these children have regression. And with that regression, if you look at their sleep EEG, they show very, very active discharges. That is quite distinct from their awake EEG, which can look normal or only show a very small amount of discharge. So let's talk about a few strategies for early diagnosis. I think what we want to do is have a high index of suspicion, particularly for those children who have onset of severe epilepsy in the first 2 to 3 years of life. We need to be aware, what are the presenting features, and we want to maintain that high degree of suspicion to look for some of those evolving features. We want to be sure that we're getting the right diagnostic workup. And I think in Lennox-Gastaut, one of the critical things to do to get that diagnosis early would be a video EEG with sleep. And oftentimes what you'll see is often very subtle tonic seizures with that characteristic generalized paroxysmal fast activity on that EEG. We want to make sure, as Tracy said, you know, we've got the syndrome, but we really want to look carefully for what is the underlying etiology to make sure that there isn't sort of a unique best therapy for that etiology. So making sure we have high-resolution neuroimaging and, really importantly, making sure that we've done genetic investigations for these children. And then making sure that we periodically review the diagnosis. I think one thing that we're not so good at as neurologists is we'll see a child, we'll put a label on them, this is what they have, and we forget to kind of re-ask that question, is that still what they have when we see them again a year down the road? So we want to be sure that we're kind of continuing to ask that question, is this still the right diagnosis? So second question for you, what change in Connor's presentation might you expect to see if he presented in his teenage years? But the answer is we actually see a reduction in slow spike wave activity. And so that's really important because some patients may not show the slow spike activity anymore in adolescence or adulthood. And that's just evolution of Lennox-Gastaut. That does not mean that they don't have Lennox-Gastaut. So let's talk a little bit about evolution of seizures. And just as it takes time to evolve into Lennox-Gastaut, we do see evolution in Lennox-Gastaut as that child goes from their preschool years to the older school years into adulthood. And what we see is change in tonic seizures. So the characteristic seizure is still a tonic seizure, and we see that most of our patients continue to have daily to weekly seizures, but what's really important is we see these tonic seizures decreasing during wakefulness but persisting during sleep. Now, oftentimes they can be quite subtle, and EEG is very helpful to pick them up, but they are there during sleep. The other thing that we see is adjustment in other types of seizures. So the typical drop attacks or the atonic seizures often reduce significantly as children go from childhood into adulthood. Atypical absences also become less frequent. Myoclonic seizures become less frequent. And status epilepticus also becomes less frequent, although it continues to be a risk, I think, at all ages. Sometimes we can see a slight increase in focal seizures, and the generalized tonic-clonic seizures generally persist. So some of the challenges in diagnosing Lennox-Gastaut in adults, I think this is more challenging for our adult colleagues if we as child neurologists have missed this diagnosis. And I think oftentimes these children or these adults now with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome live in group homes, and so we often lack people who really understand what their early history was, and that can be really, really challenging to try and find. It's often difficult to obtain records. If you are able to obtain records, you've heard from Tracy how often her daughter was in hospital. That's pretty characteristic for Lennox-Gastaut. And so these records are often coming in wheelbarrows, several of them, because there's a lot of them. And so it's really challenging, I think, for providers to go through all of that. As we already had mentioned, some of our characteristic features, like the slow spike wave, may no longer be present on EEG. And oftentimes, investigations are incomplete because they haven't had state-of-the-art genetics or neuroimaging because they're just older adults. So I think early diagnosis is really key here. So we'll talk maybe a little bit just about getting a diagnosis. Tracy, you had mentioned it took a while to get the diagnosis for Savannah, but from your experience and also the many families you've interacted with in the foundation, what is the importance of getting that accurate diagnosis for families? How does that change things?
I think it changed everything for us. The first thing it allowed us to do was actually understand what we were researching. Before that, you know, we were looking into every single thing, everything under the sun that could involve seizures, right? And so it really allowed us to narrow our research onto one specific area. The second thing was it helped us find our community. And we don't have cures, and we have really hard lives, but we do have an incredible community of support. And the community didn't start till my daughter was in her teens, but I remember when we did find it, it was just incredible. And the first time I met another LGS caregiver, I couldn't stop, like, touching her arm, you know, and she's like, okay. But just having that camaraderie and being able to share stories, and so much of what I learn now just about how decision-making is made with their loved one about did you do adaptive behavioral therapy, did you not, did that work, really comes from other caregivers as well as the support. So I think those were the two main things, but I think the third would really be a focus on the newer medications now for our young families. They're looking at our kids and going, yeah, we're good with the old stuff. We want to try the new stuff that's come out for LGS, and I can't blame them.
Thank you very much. Bethany, do you have comments? I know you see a lot of adults that are being diagnosed.
Yeah, I think my perspective is very different because I only work with adult patients. And at the University of Penn, we have a high referral network. And so we're seeing a lot of refractory epilepsy patients, a lot of patients who come in after growing from childhood to adulthood with just a poorly diagnosed, quote-unquote, seizure disorder. And I think that this is very common in a lot of different neurology practices. And not having a specific diagnosis really is a limit. It's a limitation in accessing tailored medications, but it's also a limitation in helping set expectations for what the future looks like. A lot of times in the adult world, we're taking care of patients whose parents are now elderly and who are struggling more and more to take care of them at home. And without having a diagnosis, it's very hard to tell them what the future may hold or what that may look like. And so I think the biggest impact that we've seen in our adult patients after they get over the shock of having this condition that they didn't know they had for 20 plus years, and we give them that syndrome diagnosis, I think after they get over that shock, it's next is relief and now knowing and being able to connect with support and having a community, but also being able to plan for what the future holds for their loved one and for themselves.
Thank you again for that great discussion. So I'm going to turn things over to you, Bethany. And Bethany is going to discuss the role of nurses in providing lifelong care for patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome.
Thank you, Dr. Worrell. And before I get started on my slides, I'm also going to open it up to an audience response question. So my question for you is, what is a key treatment goal in patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome? So almost everybody got the answer. It's to reduce seizure frequency and severity. And not that we wouldn't like to do any of the other things, but I think the purpose of this question is really to highlight that we want to set realistic goals and things that we're able to achieve.
So to first show a graphic of, this is not anything new to anybody in this room, just showing the importance of a multidisciplinary team in managing our most complex patients and addressing their needs. So here you can see there's a pediatrician or a primary care involved, a neurologist, support group, social worker. Nurses and NPs are in that top corner, but I would also argue that they belong in every other bucket as well, because you might see a nurse or an NP with your pediatrician, your primary care doctor, your neurologist, your specialist, and so they really are involved throughout. But to not lose the goal of all of this, which is the patient and the caregiver, so they maintain that center position. So all of these people working together to optimize that care. So really, to talk about treatment goals in Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, as far as seizures go, we really want to make sure that we're individualizing a treatment plan for them, recognizing that for this patient population, seizure freedom is really not a realistically achievable goal. And we can end up making people feel much worse if we blindly chase after that. And so instead, what we're going to target are the most problematic seizures in order to reduce the frequency and severity of those. This requires knowing your patients and their caregivers and their seizure patterns, because for some people, this may be the goal might be to keep them out of the hospital. For some, the problematic seizures are the ones that result in head injuries. One of my patients comes in all the time, and his dad works in the ER, and he gauges success based on how many times he's had to staple his son's head. And so you really have to understand where their starting point is and where you think you might be able to end up. The one caveat is if there is significant epileptic encephalopathy or cognitive impairment that you think is occurring as a response to ongoing underlying seizure activity, that may push you to be more urgent and be more aggressive in managing that seizure activity. In addition to all of these questions regarding how to manage seizures, there's also those other comorbidities that impact the patient and their caregivers as well. A lot of that has to do with adverse effects from our anti-seizure medications, and how do we balance how many medications they're on, what those side effects are, and not contributing to any of their non-seizure symptoms like behavior and sleep and GI issues. And so we really need to optimize all of these things to promote their improvements in their quality of life. To this end, there have been a lot of studies that have looked at efficacy in our anti-seizure medications for the LGS population. And I'm certainly not going to go through all of this with you, but the message that I wanted to show here is really there was no one significant medication that had better efficacy than another. This was a meta-analysis looking at 8 randomized control trials with almost 1,200 LGS patients included. They looked at 6 medications that have FDA approval for the treatment of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and they found that all of them had efficacy when compared to placebo, but none of them had substantial efficacy when compared to each other. And so there really is no one gold standard that we should be going for here. This is another graphic looking from that same study, and again, the goal here is to highlight that they all have adverse events. These are not benign medications. All of our seizure medications are working in the brain, and therefore they can cause brain side effects, including somnolence, sedation. There can be GI symptoms like decreased appetite. And so knowing what the side effects are of all of these different medications and how they relate to the other medications will be really important in targeting your treatment for your patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. One thing that's not highlighted here but important to note is that many of these medications pharmacokinetically interact with each other. And so knowing how they play with each other is also important when layering one medication on top of another medication, which is oftentimes necessary in managing the seizures of these patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So one more very busy slide to show is just an example of how we approach therapy for our patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So if you look to the left, you'll see the different pharmacological therapy guidelines that do exist for the treatment of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So the first step would be starting an anti-seizure medication, which includes valproic acid. And then from there, it talks about adjunctive therapy, going through phases with lamotrigine, rufinamide, all of these medications that were looked at in that meta-analysis. And what you can see in each one of these boxes, or maybe can't see, depending on your eyesight, because the slide's so small, is that there is a byline in each step which basically says, make sure you're going back to look at the dose of the medicine that was on previously and either consider decreasing the dose or discontinuing it if it was not efficacious for that patient. Another thing that we're very good at as neurologists is adding medications when people are in that emergency zone. They're coming in with more seizures. We're responding to that. We're reacting and we're promoting safety by adding medication. But what we're not as good at is looking at what didn't work before and how can we simplify this and clean this up to make them tolerate that medication better. And so that is an important aspect of all of your medication management. Also, just as important and has been highlighted before in this talk, is going back to that question over and over again as you're managing those seizures. Do we know what the underlying etiology is? Is there something more targeted that's now available to us that we should be thinking of? What's the best personalized approach to this syndrome, and how do we better understand that? And then the last column here is non-pharmacological therapy. So for patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, it's important to think outside of the box of medications. And this is also true for any patient who has refractory epilepsy or continued seizures despite the treatment of appropriately chosen seizure medications. They should be considered for surgery, which can promote some of the best outcomes that we have to offer for a refractory patient. And Lennox-Gastaut patients are also oftentimes eligible for a resective surgery if we're able to identify a lesion that we think is causative of, again, their most problematic seizures. In addition to resective surgery, there has been strong data in support of the ketogenic diet for treatment of patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, vagus nerve stimulation, and disconnective surgery, such as a corpus callosotomy. And there is now evolving evidence to support the use of the deep brain stimulator in patients who have Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And so you can see through this busy slide, this is really an all-hands-on-deck type situation where you're really trying to use everything that we have to treat the seizures of the patients that we are following. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk just about some care aspects of patients with Lennox-Gastaut. And an important piece of this is a seizure action plan. We really do believe that every patient and caregiver who has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome should be provided with a seizure action plan. This is really just a diagnostic tool that follows patients throughout all of their care settings. It should be easy to understand and comprehend and really goes over what their seizure presentation is like. What do their seizures look like? How often do they happen? When should anybody respond or react to them? And how should they respond or react to them? For many patients, they'll have rescue medication, and so this needs to highlight when and how that should be used. For many patients, it's a question of, do we need to call 911 every time? You've also heard how many seizures these patients have on a regular basis, and so this is not a patient population where we want EMS to be responding for every seizure, right? And so for somebody who's not used to caring for these patients, it can be very complicated to know, okay, this person's coming into my school or into my office and I've never seen them before. What do I need to know about them and how do I quickly get that information? And we think that a seizure action plan is the best way to do that. There have been studies that shown that just by having this document that follows them throughout school or day program in different care areas, this document can reduce time to action during seizures, which would then result in a better result from each seizure. Another aspect of care that's near and dear to my heart is the transition process. So I work in an adult epilepsy center. One of the hats that I wear there is I coordinate the transitions for adolescents coming into our center. And so my perspective is a lot different from those of you working in pediatric centers. But I think one thing that everybody can agree on is that this transition from pediatric to adult care is very difficult for both the patient and their caregiver. This is something that we need to plan for a long time. Failure to plan for this transition can limit both access to specialty care, newer treatment options, and ultimately result in poorer management of all of the comorbid conditions. One of the things that I've learned is most different between pediatric centers and adult centers is the disconnect between all of the different providers. I think pediatric centers do a very good job at coordinating care, where you come in and you see your neurologist, and then right from there you'll see your psychiatrist next door, and then from there you'll go downstairs and you'll have physical therapy with physiatry, and you'll get your Botox, and then you'll go home for the day. And so then to take that same patient and they age 1 year and you send them into adult care, and then you say, well, there is no psychiatry here and there's no physiatry and physical therapy is two towns away, but here's a phone number. If you're lucky, you know, we can give you a referral. And so it can be very disorienting for patients going through that process. So you can imagine the importance of preparing them for that. In addition to these aspects that are really just about that transfer from pediatric to adult care, there are a lot of other aspects of their care that need to transition too. And this is outside of the medical system. There are issues that are medical legal with guardianship, long-term care settings, health insurance will change, access to care will change, graduating from school will change, going into day programs will change. And so you can imagine what a whirlwind that is for patients and their caregivers. So the medical aspect is really just a small part of that. The good news is that by preparing properly and beginning early in care, we can make this transition go more smoothly. So here's a timeline proposed for transition planning. You want to initiate the discussion regarding transition as early as 13 and really no later. And a lot of people look at this and say, 13? Adulthood's like 18. What are we doing? And that's really how long it takes to start and finalize a plan. And so just having some sort of guideline as to like what the expectations would be when they age. Going over testing, making sure that you have a diagnosis in the pediatric center, making sure that you understand where you stand with their care. Then having conversations with social work about guardianship, social security. Does this person have capability to make their own decisions? Do they need a POA? There's a lot of discussions that need to happen that early so you can make those arrangements. Insurance coverage. And then you shift gears into identifying adult providers. In addition to having a neurologist or a seizure specialist, as I mentioned, a lot of those comorbidities will now need to be managed by other providers. And so having assistance on the pediatric side with people who they already feel comfortable with and making sure those care providers are identified really goes a long way. And then at the very end, there should be a creation of a succinct transition document by the pediatric provider. Like Dr. Worrell noted, those buckets, barrels, I think, of medical records, just by sending a patient out to an adult center with a barrel of records really isn't helping anything. That's a lot to digest. And really what we need to know on the adult side is what's important, right? So what has been done, treatments have been failed, what has been successful, and then what else is important for us to know? Some of that might be this is the deal with the family. This is the impact to other people. And so it's really not always something that you're going to be able to get from reading the medical records. There are several different resources out there for transition. This is just an example of one of them that you can find on the LGS Foundation website. This is the Care Guide. It's a resource that's designed to help families in planning for that care, long-term care for patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And in here, it includes factors to consider during the transition process, necessary preparations for adult care, and other support services and resources. I always really go back to this shared decision model in talking with my patients. And this really is important for patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome just because the care is so complex. But I do think that this is something that's helpful to keep in mind really in every patient that we touch. And the goal here is really to keep optimal patient care and that patient and caregiver at the center of everything that we do. Everything that we do in our care really should be based on what their goals are for their treatment, because when you are aligned with that with them, it can make all of the other things fall into place. And so the SHARE model will tell you to first seek the caregiver's participation in the plan. Our patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome oftentimes are not actively participating in developing this care, but if they can, you can involve the patient as well. You want to help them explore and compare the different treatment options. As you can remember a couple of slides back, there are many out there, and where do they know where to start? And so you can give them the information and let them start to look into the treatment options themselves. And then you can assess their values and their preferences, which way that would they want to go. Some people are very open to surgical options. Some people would never consider that. So making sure that you know where the patient's starting is important. You want to reach a decision with the caregiver. So you're not going to dictate what their next steps is. They should walk out of that office feeling like they made the decision. I think that that's ultimately my goal. And then you evaluate that caregiver's decision. Bring it back and say, you know, we discussed these options and this is the plan that we went with. How did that work? How are things going? I think one of the common things that I say with my patients almost on a daily basis is, this is what I see as our goal for today. Is this also your goal? Because if there's a disconnect there and the plan that I'm putting forth is not going to achieve what you want to achieve here, then you might not even come back to see me, right? This should be a partnership, and my job here is just to educate you on what the options are, and then we work together to do that. Here are a few more resources. This is for patients and caregivers. This is not specific to LGS, except for the second one. But the first one is for all rare epilepsies. And then a really nice resource at the bottom, the Deep Connections resource, has toolkits for both parents and siblings, again, to address that idea that both the patient, their caregiver, and the rest of the family are really impacted by diagnoses like these. And that's it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much,
Bethany. For that.
Thanks very much, Bethany. That was a great overview and a really nice focus on sort of shared decision making, which is really critical in these very difficult epilepsies. Bethany, the transition process is very, very challenging for families. And I think this is an area where nurses can have a significant impact. What would you say that nurses could do to improve that process for families? And wondering if you could share a little bit about what has worked well in your clinic?
I think the role that nurses will play in transition somewhat depends on where they're working. The number one role that they will play is education and expectation setting. And so if you have a relationship with a patient and their family members on the pediatric side, I think you're in a prime position to talk to them about some of these differences, what they can expect to see, what they might want to start planning for. We've done many different survey studies and have trialed different ways to transition patients into our adult center. And I used to go over to a pediatric clinic and do the last visit with them. We used to do record collection, and we've tested a whole bunch of things. And really what we found was most effective was when the pediatric patient and their family had access to me to ask those kind of questions. And they almost were never medical. They were things like, are there fish in the waiting room? Are there, a bunch of old people sitting there? Where are we going? Where do we park? How do we get a hold of the doctor when it's not the office visit? A lot of pediatric providers have given their phone numbers, and these parents are used to having that in times of emergency, and those are the kind of things that they want to make sure that once they switch to the adult side, somebody's going to pick that up. So just being able to ask those very logistical questions and get some real answers is probably the thing that I found most helpful from the nursing perspective.
Thank you. And Tracy, given your experience and also the many families that you interact with, what would you say are the major pain points in transition that you've heard from families?
I think the major pain points are, one, finding a doctor who in adult care that wants to work with your loved one. There's a lot. I mean, they were not necessarily trained the way pediatric doctors were. Pediatricians are trained in the whole child, the whole body. Another issue is that they're not trained in the whole body. They're trained in the brain. And so when you come to them and say this anti-seizure medicine is causing GI issues, they don't necessarily know what to do with that other than refer you out. I think one of the current pain points that we're dealing with right now is that with LGS, there's a lot of medication changes that happen in the short term. Oh, seizures went up by 50%. We have no idea why. Can we make a medication change? And there's really no nursing support for adult providers to make those little incremental medication changes that our doctors used to be able to do with their nurses over the phone in less than 24 hours. And then finally, seizure action plans. You know, right now we're seeing at a major academic medical center, a level 4 epilepsy center, very decorated in Southern California. And our seizure action plan is go to the emergency room if there's a problem, and let's make sure that her medication's not low and that, you know, we do a CT scan. And she doesn't need all of that. LGS seizures just change for no reason. And what we need is to alter the medication. And so I don't want to go to the emergency room. That's where I'm going to go, where she's going to get over-medicated and be put into a coma, and now I can't get her out of it and spend 2 weeks recovering. So I think those are all pretty significant pain points in the transition for most of our families.
Thank you very much. So I'm just going to provide just a brief overview of SMART goals. So we hope that with this symposium, this has helped to monitor patients and caregivers for quality of life challenges and address those challenges with resources and support where possible. We hope that you feel more confident evaluating children with a history of infantile epilepsies for Lennox-Gastaut diagnostic criteria and really understand the importance of following those children forward to see if they will evolve into Lennox-Gastaut. As Tracy has just said, the importance of providing all patients and caregivers with a detailed seizure action plan, and then finally preparing patients and caregivers for that transition period from pediatric to adult care, making sure that we initiate discussions early and we follow key milestones for successful transition. So I think we have a little bit of extra time for some questions. Maybe I'll start with Bethany. We have one question coming in on Epidiolex versus artisanal CBD. And how does Epidiolex differ from other CBD agents for treating Lennox-Gastaut?
A very good question. Epidiolex is the only FDA-approved CBD product that we use in treating patients with Lennox-Gastaut that has that FDA approval. I think that when you're thinking in treating your patients, one important difference is that you're going to have the same concentration of that drug every single time that you get it. I think that's the primary benefit of having a pharmaceutical product versus an artisanal product. Obviously, there are differences in having the clinical trial data and understanding what the potential interactions are with other medications as well as pharmacokinetic side effects. I think that when I was talking about polypharmacy and understanding all of those aspects of each drug and how they are going to combine with other drugs in these patients that have to take so much already, having that data behind you is really helpful in using those medications.
Thank you. And for Tracy, a question about, is there respite care available for families who have loved ones with Lennox-Gastaut, and what is the best way to access that?
So respite is very specific to the region that our families live in, and we have ambassadors. We have 52 ambassadors all across the U.S. So I think the best way is to reach out to the LGS Foundation, connect the family. You can email info@lgs.org. It's info@lgsfoundation.org. And we can connect them with an ambassador, because we find that the best way to find out if you have respite in your area is to talk to other families who are living in your area, because it is so region specific. And I wish there was a national resource that would just point us to them, but every time one of those gets started, they're out of date like 2 months after they've started, because these things change so quickly. But we're happy to help connect families in that way.
All right. And then there's a question on genetic testing. Bethany, are you interested in addressing that? So you touched on genetic testing. And if you could elaborate a little bit more about what that might look like for families.
Yeah, so Lennox-Gastaut syndrome does not have a gene associated with it. And so to get a diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, it's really based on that classic triad of symptoms. However, there's also oftentimes an etiology as well. And so patients who have Lennox-Gastaut syndrome should undergo genetic testing to try to identify a gene that may have been causing this. Similar to how Tracy's daughter had specific testing, and then that opened the doors for more tailored treatment. There is ongoing research going all the time looking at different genes and if there could potentially be different medications in the future that are targeted to specific genes. So all these patients should have genetic testing in childhood. This has evolved over time, so I would argue that in adulthood they should be retested and have genetic testing. Again, just always going back to readdressing the question as to how much do we understand about the diagnosis.
Great. And then there's a question virtually. What clinical features make you most suspicious that a patient has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome? And maybe I'll address that from the child standpoint and then have you address that from the adult side. But it's really, as I mentioned, it's early life onset of seizures. So typically before 3 years of age, seizures that are drug resistant. And we're particularly concerned about that group who has infantile spasms who are not responding well. And then in that situation, really asking very carefully about the drop seizures and getting that EEG and looking for that very characteristic slow spike wave and generalized paroxysmal fast activity. So from a pediatric standpoint, that would be my comment. But I think you have a tougher job in the adult epilepsy clinic, and I'd like to hear your thoughts.
So my perspective is very different because of the evolution of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. We know that many of those features do change and disappear as somebody gets older. We oftentimes also don't have access to all of their pediatric history. And so things that clue me into a patient that may have Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, I look for patients who have cognitive impairment. We are also very tuned into drop seizures or tonic seizures. But in adulthood, they are oftentimes sometimes in sleep and subtle, and these patients are not monitored very closely when they're sleeping. So we are almost little detectives in trying to figure out, may they have a history of drop attacks or tonic seizures? So are they wearing a helmet? Are they coming into clinic with elbow pads? Do they have a history of any kind of facial or head injury from a seizure with a drop? And so those are the kind of things that we're trying to clue ourselves into. We don't look as much for the generalized slow spike wave discharges on the EEG because we know that in many of the patients they won't have that. But we do look for other features such as multifocal discharges or generalized paroxysmal fast activity that may be associated with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome in adulthood.
And I would just add, if I could, we have a lot of families in our community who are LGS-like, and if they are living with a lot of seizures, they are more than welcome at the LGS Foundation where they can learn from other families.
All right. And Tracy, I'm going to give you about a minute for this, which is probably too short. What is the best way to, or best way to access help for managing behavior issues in Lennox-Gastaut? Who have you found to be most helpful in that?
Yeah, so we've had this course that's been done by Eileen Devine about brain-first parenting, and she talks about how we have 20-second kids in a two-second world. And it's really about thinking about taking a step back and thinking about why these kids are behaving this way, trying to figure out, is this a seizure? And is this just a behavior? Are they just being obstinate because they do that? Or is this something that they've never learned? And I think that that's been really helpful. We actually have a course at the LGS Foundation. It's absolutely free. Our families can sign up and take Eileen's course about this. And it's really a major topic in our area.
Thank you very much. So I think we're almost at time. I'd like to say if you have colleagues who have missed today's live presentation, this activity will be available on the Neuropsychiatry Education Hub on CME Outfitters' website. A downloadable copy of the seizure action plan that Bethany shared is also available there. And I'd like to very much thank Drs. Tracy Dixon-Salazar and Bethany Thomas for joining me today. Thank you so much for this great program. And I also want to thank CME Outfitters for their assistance in developing today's program, and then very importantly to you, our audience, for your kind attention and for participating and providing really, I think, critical questions, and hopefully we can go forward and provide the best care for patients with Lennox-Gastaut and their family. Thank you very much.